I'm waiting for the blue light.
Blue light special.
Yep, exactly. Okay. Good afternoon and welcome to the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee for February 25th, Monday. We have some interesting bill up today. This is a continuation of a discussion from last session. We are going to also hold a work session, and then last but not least, we have a special guest that's going to be providing a Water 101. I'm really pleased to have Janet Newman here, who I've known for years, and is a former Lewis and Clark Law School professor and one of the most, renowned water law folks in the West. And so we're really pleased to have her here today. I will give her a more thorough introduction in just a bit. But with that, I'm going to hand the gavel over to my vice chair, who is going to run the committee for the raccoon bill today. Rocky Raccoon, we're dubbing this.
And they don't see the...
Oh, they didn't get the memo. Yeah. We have a new rule that the late members need to buy the chair dark chocolate bars for every day that they're late. So I can't
you will
wait.
You'll weigh 300 pounds.
So with that, I'm handing over the gavel for my vice chair to open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 474.
I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 474. And would Mr. Selinger and Mr. Anglin from ODFW come up?
Do you make this stuff up?
And Beth is going to, you want to tell us what the bill is?
Yeah, so the bill, Senate Bill 474, adds raccoons to the list of potentially habituated wildlife.
Whoever would like to go first?
Yeah. Good afternoon, Chair Dinkfelder and members of the Senate and
we
committee.
Can, wait, he's right. The chair right now.
Oh. Sorry about that. Good afternoon, Chair Olson and members of the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. My name is Bob Salinger. I'm here today testifying on behalf of Audubon Society of Portland and our 13,000 members in the Portland metro area in support of Senate Bill 474 to add raccoons to the list of potentially habituated wildlife. First off, I want to thank Senator Olson and Senator Haas for sponsoring the legislation. We think this is an important bill. Our Wildlife Rehabilitation Center deals with about 15,000 calls a year from the public regarding wildlife, and many of those calls are concerns, complaints precipitated by people deliberately feeding animals. It's a big problem. People do it sometimes with the best of intentions, sometimes with not so good intentions, but people put out food for all kinds of animals. And the problem with that is those animals become habituated. When they become habituated, they lose their fear of humans, their natural instincts. They start to cause damage. They can become threats to people. Also, they tend to congregate in larger numbers, and you start to get disease outbreaks as well. And the result isn't good for people or wildlife. What happens typically is eventually those animals are removed from the environment. And we've seen a dramatic increase in nuisance trapping in the Portland metro area over the past 25 years. The vast majority of those problems are animals that are habituated. They would be fine, do just fine on the landscape, but for the fact that people have fed them. A couple of years ago, 2011, House Bill 2175 was passed that prohibited feeding a large number of species. And that has been actually very effective. There was a concern at the time there would be huge amounts of enforcement. That hasn't been the case. What we found, though, is that when we go out and educate people about feeding wildlife, it's tremendously effective if, as we tell them, here's why it's bad for the animals, here's why it's bad for you and your community. If we can also add in at the end of that, also it is legal and you can be cited for it. And we talk about that in terms of coyotes, which is one of the animals that was on that list. Unfortunately, raccoons was left off. But it's just a way to wake people up and make them realize that a variety of organizations find it problematic, and that if they persist, they can be cited. In most cases, that's enough to stop people from doing it. In the vast majority of cases that we deal with, people cease and desist. And in the cases where they're more obstinate about it, informing them that they can be cited, that they can be reported, that's enough. We deal with at least 100 phone calls a year with raccoons, an equal number, sometimes more with coyotes. And we've only referred on, in the coyote situation, a handful to state police over the last 2 years for follow-up. And my understanding is in the vast majority of those, they simply went out and talked to folks, and that was sufficient to fix the problem. So really, this bill is a win-win. It's not resulting in lots of people getting cited. It's not resulting in a ton of referrals to state police, but it is solving the problem. It's sending the message that we need to send. So our hope is that you will pass this. We think it's a good addition, and I think it will be good for people and for wildlife. So thank you.
Mr. Anglin.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. For the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And Bob summarized things very well. We do see this as a way in those cases where somebody refuses to stop feeding, and there are problems, that does give state police and other law enforcement officers some options to deal with that. Typically, or not typically, but in a lot of cases when we do end up in situations with raccoons that are habituated to feeding, Bob is correct. We have had severe distemper outbreaks, which then can be very serious for pets in the neighborhood as well as for people potentially, and it usually results in the death of a lot of raccoons, which is unfortunate for those raccoons. Frequently we're dealing with cases where it's neighbors that are not feeding, have dogs that are being, or cats that are being attacked because raccoons are attracted into the area, and they've requested assistance from us that usually results in a killing of the raccoons. Again, raccoons attracted in and looking for food, and they build up in large numbers. We've also had cases where people are feeding raccoons, and it's resulted in attracting bears in, and bears being in the people's backyard, and people being afraid then to go outside and wanting us to remove the bear, but they refuse to quit feeding the raccoons. So, you know, this bill, adding raccoons in with the other species, like I said, would give OSP an option then in the future for, in those cases where it's appropriate, that they could take the necessary action to try and put a stop to that and be a win for wildlife. Thank you.
Are there any questions?
I have one.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. I have a question about what other states do. I don't recall, I don't know if anybody asked this last session when we heard this legislation. Do other states have similar legislation where they cite people for habituation of raccoons that you know of? I'm just curious how widespread an issue, especially in the West or throughout the country, this is.
Vice Chair Olson, Senator Dingfelder, you know, we didn't look at that specifically for the last bill. I do know, from my discussion with my counterparts in other states, I think it's a mixed bag, and it just depends on the area. Certainly, even here in Oregon, some cities have adopted ordinances that prohibit the feeding of wildlife. This obviously makes it good for outside the city limits, but we did not research that specifically with the other states.
I would just add, too, that there are a number of states in the East that I know of, in part because of rabies, that have banned feeding. So, as Ron said, it's a mixed bag, county level, local level, and then also statewide in various places.
Thank you.
Senator Hansel.
I was just curious, why wasn't it included in the original bill?
My recollection is that some members of the legislature actually like to feed raccoons. And politically, we were advised it was there were a number of animals taken out, and we were told you could probably get coyotes back in. Raccoons may be problematic for this reason, and so we backed away from that as a political concession.
Thank you.
Well, let me ask this question then. In reading the bill, and it was appropriate last time, I supported it last time, and Senator Haas and I are on this bill for the raccoons. If a person feeds cats outside, and that's where their cats are, or if they feed their dogs outside, they're not intentionally feeding a raccoon. So this, would this bill preclude them from being cited for feeding a raccoon? Or is it only when they actually physically lay out food to draw those wildlife in that this bill takes into counts them? Either one.
You want to take it, or I can try.
So, Vice Chair Olson, Obviously, that's one that Oregon State Police, if they were investigating, would have to look at on a case-by-case basis. We have had incidences of just exactly what you're describing in the past, and raccoons all of a sudden show up. And our advice to the people is, you know, you can feed your pets outside, just pick it up at night, which is typically when the raccoons would come in and remove the food source from them. And in the cases that if the problem were to persist and were to get worse, and they did not take positive action on their own in a case like that, then OSP would have the option to take action if they wished.
And I would just add, too, that we work very closely with the Feral Cat Coalition. We have a very good relationship with them. And we've run this by them. You know, we've talked to them about this. We feel that, and they feel that we can work around this. They advise people to only feed for 60 minutes a day and then take the food up, because it's not good for the cats to draw in the wildlife either. So, and in 20 years of working at Audubon, we've never had a situation with pets where we've had relatively few that even involve pets, but where we've never had a situation that we couldn't resolve quickly without, you know, that wasn't their goal to feed the animal, the raccoons or the coyotes or whatever they were feeding. So we were able to resolve those very easily. So I don't see this as a risk to those folks. It's not, they're not the target.
I think as I recall from 2011, the issue was the fact that people were afraid that if they fed their pets outside, that this law would be aimed at them, and it's really not. It's aimed at those folks that want to bring that wildlife in, and I think this is a good bill and should be passed on. Are there any other people that would like to testify to this bill?
Mr. Vice Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
I just have a comment, and I appreciate you bringing this bill forward, because I do support this bill. But the way that I read it, especially on line 10, now, I'm not an attorney, although we have one sitting right behind you. It says, a person who places, deposits, distributes, stores, or scatters food, garbage, or any other attractant so as to knowingly constitute a lure. So I would imagine that's a pretty high bar. Somebody's leaving pet food out for their pets. That's one thing. If they're leaving pet food out to lure raccoons, I have my senses that would be something else. So the way that I read it, I would think that the law enforcement would take that into account.
Vice Chair Olson, Senator Dingfelder, that certainly is the case, and that certainly falls in line with when we get involved in things like this. Most of the time it is inadvertent, and it's the type of advice that we offer to the resident to bring your food in. Here's the things you can do to minimize those encounters.
A final question then. If, in fact, this, by people feeding their pets outside, it does cause a problem, this would give the police a tool to say, you know, you must abide by what we ask you to do, or you can possibly get cited under this law. Would that be the case?
Vice Chair Olson, I'm not 100% sure on that, and I'd have to talk with OSP about that. And, you know, I think it's designed for them to have the maximum amount of flexibility, and on a case-by-case basis, based on the interviews with the individual, be able to determine what they need to do.
Okay.
I think one thing that would be helpful is just that, you know, the cases that really have been egregious have been remarkable. The cases where somebody's putting out 50 and 100 pounds of dog food a night, 50 and 60 raccoons are coming in, they're not territorial, so they will start to congregate. They are extraordinary cases. The small stuff we deal with, ODF&W deals with, and we deal with it very effectively and quickly and in a positive, constructive way. The cases that we're seeing where that this is really targeted at it are really extraordinary and very obvious when you see them.
Senator Bates.
Just a quick question. If you're living in a community or a city that has not passed an ordinance against this, and this law goes in effect, would the homeowner who is concerned about having an extra neighbor doing this, would they have to call the state police, or could they then call the city police and have them come over and take a look at it?
The calls tend to come in. People don't know who to call for wildlife in a lot of cases. They call ODF&W. They may call Audubon. They call Multnomah County Animal Control in Portland. So it's a variety of places, and a lot of different resources are prepared to give them quick answers and advice that, again, often solve the problem immediately without going to a law enforcement situation, and then typically we wind up referring things on to state police. So it sort of goes through those filters first, more often than not.
I'm not sure I've made my question clear. Let's say you're living in Medford, Oregon, and there's no municipal ordinance against putting food out for raccoons, and your next door neighbor is doing it, and you don't want them to do it anymore, and you talk to them, and they said, no, we're not going to change. Would you be able to call with this bill becomes law, would you be able to call your local city police, or would you have to call the state patrol to take action?
So the law is the law, and they have to enforce the law.
Yeah.
We call either one?
That's correct. Vice Chair Olson and Senator Bates, they could call either any police officer to enforce the law.
I just wanted to be sure.
Yes.
They could call either one. Because in some parts of the state, that becomes very important.
Yes.
In some parts of the state don't have any county deputies, and there's maybe three or four state patrol officers to cover thousands of square miles. They're not going to come up with something like this. I don't blame them.
If there's no further testimony, would anyone else like to testify on Senate Bill 474? If there's no further testimony, I'll close the public hearing on Senate 474, and we will move we're going to carry over the work session until February 27th.
Thanks.
I will open a work session on Senate Bill 198.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 198 that you have in front of you has a -2 amendment. The -2 amendment is very similar to the amendment that you had in front of you when this bill was originally heard on 218. The change to this is that the new amendment stipulates that the act does not require the court to take additional action after the conclusion of sentencing to secure license or permits if it is not in the defendant's position.
Would you like a motion?
I would like to entertain a motion.
Okay, Vice Chair Olson, I move to adopt the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 198.
Senator Dinkfelder moves to adopt the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 198. Is there any discussion? If there is no further discussion, is there any objections? If not, the amendments are adopted. By gavel?
Mm-hmm. Vice Chair Olson, I move that Senate Bill 198, as amended with the -2s, be reported out of committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Dingfelter moves that Senate Bill 198 be reported out of committee with a due pass as amended recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bates?
Aye.
Senator Hanson?
Aye.
Senator Haas?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Dingfelter?
Aye.
The motion passes. Senator Haas, would you like to carry this bill?
I'd be happy to.
Thank you very much. Senator Haas will carry. And we will close the work session on Senate Bill 198. And now we'll pass it down.
Right.
And somebody else gets to do this.
Thank you, Vice Chair. That was probably the most efficient hearings that we've had and work sessions of this committee, so thank you for that. I hope I don't get voted off the island now. Thank you very much, and appreciate you bringing that bill forward. Now I'm going to open up an informational hearing. We will begin our Water Law 101, or Water Policy 101. I'd like to invite up Janet Newman. And this is our continuing education for our committee on some of the big issues that are before this committee. I'd like to introduce Janet Newman, who I've known for many, many years. She's senior counsel with Tonkin Torp's Water Law and Environmental and Natural Resources Practice Groups. She represents clients in a variety of water and natural resources related matters. But Jan is considered one of the foremost water law specialists in Oregon and is nationally recognized as a water law scholar. She's also a frequent speaker and writer on water law and policy. She's very knowledgeable about water and natural resource law and policy in Oregon and throughout the West. We're very fortunate to have her here today. She's many years of experience with these issues and a wealth of connection through different agencies, water management entities, policymakers. She was a tenured, Jan was a tenured professor at Lewis and Clark Law School, where she taught water law, administrative law, property law, and other natural resource classes. She was also associate dean of faculty and co-director of the Natural Resources Law Institute at the Northwest Water Law and Policy Project at Lewis and Clark. And prior to her academic career, Jan was director of the Oregon Department of State Lands, the agency responsible for managing Oregon's Common School Funds and also our wetland program. Before working in state government, I learned that she began her legal career at Tonkin Torp in Minneapolis, and so it's sort of full circle that you're back there, 30 years later. Mm-hmm. But we're very honored to have you come here, and I appreciate you coming on such short notice because we've been hearing a lot from the Water Resources Department. We thought it would be wonderful to have a tenured law professor that can provide us with sort of an overview to lay the foundation for many of the issues we'll be working on this session. So thank you, and appreciate you coming here on your own time to help us with these issues.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As Senator Dingfelder has said, I'm Jan Newman, currently senior counsel at Tonkin Torp, but I'm happy to have a chance to come here and do a teaching opportunity again, having just retired about a year and a half ago from about 20 years on the faculty at Lewis and Clark. I'd really like to thank Senator Dingfeld for inviting me here today. What I'm going to try to do is give you a very condensed summary of Oregon water law, and I'll try to outline within the next hour the basic framework of the law and policies governing water management in the state to provide you with the context for a couple of bills I know you've had before you already and more that are likely coming your way from both the Water Resources Department and from other sources as well. So I will probably start going a little fast, and if it's too fast, just slow me down, but buckle your seat belts, and here we go. And I'm happy to take questions at any point during the presentation.
I was going to say, if you do have questions, just let me know, and we'll flag it, because probably Jan will be going pretty quickly through this.
Yes, and I'm going to try to cram in a lot of information, but try to keep it at a fairly high level so it won't be like drinking from a fire hose. And before talking about current Oregon water law, I want to set out a little bit of brief historical and national context, because it really helps to put state law into this historical context in order to understand some of the issues that continue to arise today that often surprise people who aren't familiar with the background of water law. First of all, when a lawyer says, "I do water law," what they generally mean is that they deal with the law of water quantity, not with allocation of water and use of water, rather than water quality or the regulation of what's in it. And in fact, the legal systems for managing quantity and quality are, for the most part, still pretty bifurcated. And you all know, I mean, through your general committee work, if nothing else, you all know that that doesn't necessarily make sense because the two are obviously inextricably connected. But the reason for this is historical, and we're sort of stuck with some bifurcation because of the history. And that's because water was viewed as a resource or property to be divided up long before it was viewed as pollution to be cleaned up. And for those same historical reasons, water law is primarily a body of, or several bodies of, state law. And of course, that should bother you as well, because you know that rivers and aquifers cross state lines. But that's where it's in the state courts and the state legislatures where the basic principles of water quantity or water allocation principles developed. So what we have, and this is part of the problem that we live with today, what we have is a set of water allocation principles that stretches back a couple of centuries, developed largely within state courts and legislatures, and then juxtaposed on top of that a relatively new scheme, at least stretching back a few decades only, juxtaposed on top of that a relatively new scheme of water quality and other pollution control regulation that originates largely in federal laws. And then, in addition to federal pollution laws, we have the juxtaposition of other federal laws pertaining to interstate water development for purposes of, flood control, navigation, reclamation, and so forth, endangered species and other environmental regulation, and then Supreme Court cases, United States Supreme Court cases, governing the allocation of water between states, because obviously that's where states have to go when they have a dispute. So right off the bat, you can see that there's tension built into the system and federalism challenges and problems built into the system and lots of push and pull there, and that will come up in even very simple contexts in very simple bills that come before you. Another important legacy of water law's historical development is that we generally have two overarching systems of state water law. Now, I said it's a system of state law, but there's sort of two overarching doctrines, one in the east and one in the west. And that the breakdown is roughly along the 100th meridian of longitude. And if the way that I always remember where that is that it basically cuts the Oklahoma panhandle right off. So if, you know, it goes through the Great Plains states from North Dakota all the way down into Texas. And the significance of that line is that that's where the precipitation regime changes. On the east of that line, you can support agriculture without irrigation. You know, there's enough precipitation, natural precipitation, that you don't need irrigation. Now, it may be helpful and more productive, but, you know, it's not necessary. West of that line, the precipitation drops below 20 inches a year, often way below 20 inches a year in most places, and you need irrigation. Now, the east was the first to be settled by the Europeans, and they were therefore the first state courts and legislatures to deal with disputes over water allocation. And the eastern states pretty much borrowed the principles of English common law. And what that was, well, both England and the eastern United States are relatively wet places. There's normally plenty of water to go around. There's plenty of natural precipitation. And what developed in those contexts was what's known as the riparian system of water law. And very, very briefly, I mean, there's a lot of case law and context to this, but very briefly, the riparian doctrine of water law is kind of a share and share alike system. Who gets water rights? Any riparian. Now, a riparian is somebody who owns property that abuts a watercourse of some kind. So there are plenty of property owners that aren't riparians. They don't necessarily have water rights. But all riparians have a water right. What they have is an equal and correlative right to use water from the water body that they abut. Correlative meaning it's a shared right with every other riparian. So it's not the same, you know, it's not a set amount at all times. It adjusts according to how many different people there are who are riparian and who are trying to use water. How much water do you get in a water right as a riparian? A reasonable amount. Nice, mushy, you know, undefined term. Where can you use it? On riparian land. So you can't take it away from the water basin. You know, generally the traditional riparian principles say you can only use it on riparian land. When can you use it? Whenever you want. I mean, if you know, there could be somebody who's been a riparian or had riparian property in continuous ownership for 100 years that's been using water a particular way. There might be somebody who shows up tomorrow and they have an equal and correlative right to get into the system and use water as well. What do you do when there's a shortage? Well, first of all, a shortage in riparian jurisdictions is not all that frequent. I mean, I will say recently it's been becoming more frequent in the eastern United States. But you don't have absolute annual shortages in most of the riparian states the way you do in the West. You have occasional cyclical droughts or, you know, or dry periods. So what happens when there's a shortage? Everybody reduces pro rata. I mean, that's the theory. Sometimes they don't, and then they end up in court or, you know, in a fight about it. But this kind of system works fine as long as there's basically enough water and as long as there's also this notion that there's enough precipitation to handle the properties that aren't riparian trying to use water directly out of a water course. And, of course, when there's groundwater available as well to various property owners. So that's the system that developed in the areas that were first settled in the United States. Moving west, you know, as the settlers moved west, these principles were not very useful, or they became demonstrated to be not very useful. First of all, there weren't very many riparian landowners because so much of the settlement on western land was taking place on the public domain. You know, both mining developments, even homestead developments, timber cutting, all kinds of things were occurring on land that was not owned by the person who was doing the activity. Also, there's not nearly as much water. I mean, there's obviously, there are some large water courses, large river systems in the West, but it's not, if you look at a map of the East and the West does not have the spider webs of, you know, lots and lots of perennial, permanently running river systems like the East does. And all the land, to some degree, needs irrigation in order to be productive. And that's even the land that's riparian. You know, just because you're right next to a river in a western state doesn't mean that you can grow anything unless you're getting a flood from that river. So all the land needed irrigation water. Because of all these geographic and climatic realities, new legal principles developed for this area west of the 100th Meridian. And it's called the Doctrine of Prior Appropriation. And I said, you know, riparians is share and share alike. Not so in the West. You know, prior appropriation is first in time, first in right, use it or lose it. It is not a sharing system at all. Who can get a water right in a prior appropriation system? Anybody. They don't, you know, they have to be riparian. They don't have to be anywhere near a water source. Anybody who can use water productively, riparian or not. How much water can they get in a water right? As much as they need to accomplish their so-called beneficial use or their purpose. And that's, to some degree, that's a fixed amount. I mean, it's actually not as fixed as we'd like to think, but it's a set amount according to what you're doing as opposed to whatever you want correlative with your neighbors. And where can you use it? Anywhere. You know, you can take water from the Columbia River to Southern California. I mean, it's been proposed. You know, you can take water from the Colorado River all over the place. So there's no limit to riparian lands. When do you, you know, when can you get a water right? You have to get it by putting water to beneficial use, and then you have it. And if somebody comes later and there's not any more water left, they can't jump into the system like they can in a riparian jurisdiction. What do you do when there's a shortage? Well, and recognizing that in the western states, there are shortages in many, many stream systems every single year. You know, by July or August or September, streams are running dry. So what do you do when you have a shortage on an annual basis? You cut off the juniors. So, the latecomers are the ones who have to stop their water use. There's no prorata adjustment, no prorata sharing. You just keep going back until whoever's left has enough water for their use. First of all, and then, you know, once the water is all appropriated or used up, latecomers are just out of luck unless they can try to get some away from one of the existing users. First of all, this system just developed on a customary basis. I mean, it actually arose out of the gold mining system in California, where mining claims were first in time, first in right, use it or lose it. The water users started to adopt the same principles. And it wasn't too long before these became codified in statute. But you know, originally they were just, you did it. You went out and applied the water to beneficial use. That gave you a water right. And then eventually those got codified. And every western state has a so-called water code. I mean, a bunch of statutes. You know, sometimes, I mean, if you look at California's water code, it's, you know, many volumes long. Oregon's even is many statutes long. That's not so in the East. I mean, most of the water disputes in the East are still handled in the courts. Some states have adopted so-called water codes, but they're not nearly comprehensive. You know, they deal with a few little principles or a few issues of water use. One of my favorite water law writers is a person named Carol Rose, who used to be a professor at Yale.
Sorry, someone is calling our speakerphone number.
Oh, okay. I'll just keep going.
It's a student that heard you talking.
Yeah. That's not what you told me.
Yeah.
Anyway, Carol Rose describes this development of these two different systems of water law doctrine as crystals versus mud. You know, when you have a resource that's plentiful, you don't have a lot of disputes about its use, and the principles dividing it up can be pretty muddy. They can be pretty loosey-goosey. So the riparian doctrine is very loosey-goosey. When you have a resource that's very scarce and important to people, the allocation principles tend to develop much more rigidly and precisely. You want to know who's got the right to use, you know, what at any given point in time. So they get crystalline systems that develop. So we live in a state that has some of both, and I'll come around to that in just a moment. It's oversimplified by saying we have two systems, riparian and prior appropriation. There's really three. There's pure riparian states who've never done anything else. There are pure prior appropriation states. And then there are hybrid states. And Oregon is one of the hybrid states. Now, the hybrid states are those where there are both wet areas and dry areas. It's as simple as that. And if you think about this map, if you picture the map again, the states down the 100th meridian, North, South Dakota, Nebraska, Oklahoma, et cetera, have wetter areas on the eastern side of the state. But by the time you cross the 100th meridian, it's starting to get pretty dry. The West Coast, same way. We have the wetter areas on the coastal side of the state and in the valleys. And then as you get to the eastern side of the state, we have, you know, very, very dry conditions that are similar to what you have in Idaho, Utah, you know, some of the intermountain West states. So in these states with some of each kind of topography and climatic conditions, the wet areas were generally settled first. And again, the courts and the legislatures borrowed the riparian principles from the eastern states and the English common law and started to apply those when they could among riparians. This is really bad to see all those boxes of Kleenex up there. It's definitely flu season. So they applied riparian doctrine where they could, but then as the dry areas developed later, generally these states shifted to prior appropriation because you have to reconcile. You can't choose both. I mean, if you think about it, I'm sure many of you are parents. If you can say, okay, I've got one cookie. You know, who gets the cookie? The oldest kid. That's prior appropriation, right? Or the first to get there, if you want to race, that's prior appropriation. Or you can say you share it, but you can't do both on the same cookie. You know, they're not systems that fit together. So in all but three states, the hybrid states eventually, you know, started recognizing riparian principles, moved going forward only to prior appropriation. The states that And what they generally did was recognize the riparian rights that were being used at the time they codified the prior appropriation doctrine as the choice going forward, and sort of recognize those as vested riparian rights, but didn't recognize any new ones going forward. There are three states that still try to honor both, California, Nebraska, and Oklahoma, and it's a mess. So I'm glad that we are sequentially hybrid as opposed to trying to do it simultaneously. So let me drill down on Oregon now a little bit. As I mentioned, Oregon historically recognized both riparian and prior appropriative rights, and they did it in the places where they worked, you know, in the wet areas of the state where people were actually settling riparian land and owning riparian land. Riparian principles could resolve water disputes. As soon as the Oregon gold rushes started to occur on federal lands or other activities of settlement and homesteading started to occur on federal land in the dry parts of the state, the riparian principles weren't any good. So there were early statutes that recognized prior appropriation in the places where it worked. And then by 1909, this state adopted a water code. And we weren't the earliest, but we were, you know, kind of, I mean, I think 1899, Wyoming was the earliest comprehensive water code. Washington, I think, is 1917. I want to say California is about 1913. So, you know, but we're kind of right there in the mix. So as of 1909, we had a comprehensive water code adopted in the state, and much of it is still intact. I mean, we've obviously added and amended to some degree, but a lot of it is there. There are a couple different key parts of the water code. I mean, there are lots of parts to it, but two or three key things that are important. One is that it declares that all water belongs to the public. And, you know, that's an important starting place. So it declares that all water belongs to the public in trust by the state, and that you must have a permit from the state in order to use it. There are some exceptions for diffused surface water, springs that might occur on your land that don't run off anywhere else. They stay on your land. So there are some sources of water that are not within this big scoop of public ownership, but most of them are.
I was going to say exempt groundwater.
Well, I was going to say originally it was just surface water.
Right.
In 1927, the east of the Cascades, groundwater was pulled into regulation by the Water Code, also under a prior appropriation system. And then in 1955, statewide groundwater regulation was enacted. Now, the fact that they're both under the code, groundwater and surface water, and that they both use prior appropriation doesn't necessarily mean that they are conjunctively managed as one interconnected resource. So that's still a problem, and I can get into that a little bit later as well. Okay, so you adopt this water code in 1909 in our case. We already had some pre-existing prior appropriative rights that had been established under earlier statutes or by using it, the water, and we had some pre-code riparian rights that were also claimed and that were preserved, vested and recognized by the 1909 Water Code. So the adjudications that you hear about, the Klamath Basin adjudication and a number of others that have occurred with less fanfare around the state are designed to deal with those pre-code rights. Because there was a lot of settlement and a lot of, activity in the state before 1909. So the adjudications are special administrative, kind of hybrid administrative and court procedures whereby successors in title to early settlers who claimed water rights as riparians, they come into the administrative and court process and try to prove up their pre-code rights, and then those are recognized by the courts, and so they can be integrated into the post-code permits that are issued. So how does the system actually work? In addition to having this sort of basic underpinning of public ownership, the important kind of pivot point, I guess, of the statute is you have to apply for a permit to get a water right, and it's a two-step process. A permit, you get a permit first, and the permit specifies what you're allowed to do. It also specifies a timetable on which you're supposed to do it. And then when you have done what's allowed by your permit, you essentially come into the department and do what's called proving up your water right. So you show that you've used it according to your permit, and then you're issued a water right certificate, which is considered the sort of formal vested form of water right. There's a little twist to that, though, that I want to come back to in a moment. But coming back to the permit stage, what do you get when you get a permit? You, after a review for water availability, there needs, in theory, you don't need to know if there's water available because in the prior appropriation system, when there's not enough, you just cut off the junior users. So it doesn't necessarily matter. But if you want some water in the stream or if you want people not to be angry all the time because their water rights aren't satisfied, it's a good idea to know if there's water available. So water availability is assessed, injury to other existing water rights holders, and the public interest are all assessed in the application process for a permit. When you are issued a permit, it specifies, and these are crystalline rules. It specifies the source of water. I mean, it's a very specific stream or creek or river or lake or aquifer. It specifies a point of diversion, very specific space, again, where you actually divert from your water source or a point of appropriation if it's a well, a legal description of where that is, a very specific amount. And sometimes it's expressed in cubic feet per second as a flow rate. Sometimes it's expressed in acre feet, of total volume. Sometimes it has a flow rate with a cap of a volume. A specific beneficial use. I mean, you can't just say, I want to use water for something good. You have to say, I want to irrigate. I want to run a hydropower facility. I want to use water for municipal purposes, domestic purposes, whatever it is. You have to specify your beneficial use, and then that's what you get the permit for. A place of use. You have to specify the place of use. Now, usually that is a plot of land. Sometimes it might be a stretch of stream, but we'll come back to that in a moment. A time of use. You know, is it year-round, 24/7? Is it irrigation season? When is it? And then the most important piece is the priority date. And the priority date is determined by when you apply for your permit. You know, that sort of gets you in line. You get your time stamp, and then assuming everything goes according to plan and according to schedule, that will be the priority date for your water right. So source, amount, beneficial use, you know, type of use, place of use, point of diversion, time of use, and priority date. Those are the elements of your water right. And then developing your right in accordance with all those terms eventually allows you to turn it into a water right certificate. Because depending on how complicated your use is, you know, it may take you a few years to get your point of diversion and your system in place for whatever you're going to do. So once you get a vested water right certificate, it's some kind of a property right, but what exactly is it? Well, it's called a usufructuary right, a usufruct, and that is a use right as opposed to a fee ownership right. So it's a different kind of creature, and that makes sense when you realize that the state statute declares that the public owns the water. So what you get as a property right as a water rights holder is a usufruct. Or a use right. And the perhaps trickier thing about a water right is that even when you have a vested water right, you know, a formal water right certificate that has all these very specific terms in it, it's essentially subject to a condition subsequent, which is that you continue to use the water in all the ways that your certificate says and for beneficial use. For your particular beneficial use. If, as time goes on, you actually need less water to accomplish your beneficial use, then your water right, in theory, shrinks accordingly. So it's a specific amount, but it's a specific amount for a type of use. So this continued beneficial use requirement is part of the use it or lose it aspect of water right. If you stop using it entirely, you can forfeit it. You know, there's a 5-year forfeiture period. Somebody else can come in and file an affidavit saying you haven't been using your right, and the department will go through a potential cancellation process, and you can lose your right for 5 years of non-use. So it's a first-in-time, first-in-right, use-it-or-lose-it system. You would think that given all these very specific requirements and the scarcity of water in general, that there would be heavy measurement requirements for water rights. In fact, that's not been the case. I mean, for the first many, many years, there was no specific requirement for measuring and monitoring and reporting. More recent years, permits have required measurement devices. They are not. That's not a requirement that's universally enforced. And the department has, some of you probably remember this from last session, that the department has a massive plan for trying to get measurement devices in around the state for all the water rights, because it's very hard to manage a resource when you don't know how much you have at any given point in time and how much someone's using, even though their water right says what they're supposed to be using. So measurement issues are something that are very live today. So again, I feel like I'm repeating myself to some extent, but all of these elements I've listed are integral parts of your water right. So if you want to change any of them, you need state approval. Now, the one thing you can't change is your priority date. You know, that's fixed. And the older it is, the better off you are, and the more protective you're going to be of it. But everything else, the place of use, the source of use, the amount, well, not the amount, because that becomes a new request for a new water right, but the place of use, the point of diversion, the time of use, the type of use, and the source, could all be changed with permission granted by the department. And those are all those changes are called sort of unhelpfully transfer proceedings. I mean, the water right, the water use might not be transferring from one party to another, excuse me, at all, but it's just kind of a term of art that we call it a transfer approval when any of those issues are being requested for change. At this point, the department reviews the request for transfer for injury to other water rights. And this is a place where the crystalline rule of first in time, first in right is softened a little bit by the way the system actually works. In other words, you have a whole list of people on a stream that have water rights. Let's just talk irrigation for a moment. And someone comes in and wants to change their point of diversion from one place to another place, that could have a significant impact on the other folks on the stream. If it's very possible in many places in Oregon that the other people on the stream are actually using the leftover return flow from, you know, one of the other users. They take water out, maybe they have a 60% efficient irrigation system, 40% of their water is going back into the water source, and that's actually what somebody else is using. So even though technically, the priorities, you know, are what governs who's got the superior rights. When you come in for a transfer approval, the question will be whether the change will injure other water rights holders. And so that will sometimes prevent you from making certain changes to your water right, even if you are a more senior user. And there's been quite a bit of activity on the transfer front over the last few years because there are some places where new water rights are just not available. There is no more water to be handed out. And we expect to see a lot more transfers in the next few years.
We have a couple of questions. I'm going to ask one, and then I think Senator Olson, I saw that leaning forward asking a question, a motion. Can you talk about over-appropriation and how does a basin get over-appropriated?
Yes. Okay. A basin gets over-appropriated because the water availability tests were not applied. I mean, the water availability rules that are followed now are fairly recent. So before people started worrying about that, they could just the department could, if nobody objected, they could hand out water rights. And because we don't have full stream gauging around the state and we don't have full measurement of water courses and water uses, many, many streams became over-appropriated fairly early on, at least during, like, the summertime. I mean, maybe...
Can you walk through what would happen? So that means that the Water Resources Department gave out more water than there is in the stream at that certain time.
Yep. And what happens, I mean, if you talk to a water master, you know, the enforcement personnel in the field or on the ground for the water resource departments are the water masters around the state. They're woefully understaffed and underfunded, but they're out there. And what they do is they're the ones who enforce the priorities. And so in a stream that's over-appropriated come July 1st, you might hear a water master say, I'm regulating back to 1898 on the 4th of July. And what that means is that after the 4th of July, there's not enough water in the stream to satisfy anybody with a newer water right than 1898. So on all these streams where there's over-appropriation in the summer months particularly, people are getting cut off. So only the senior water users are getting their water.
Senator Olson? Did you have a question?
Yeah, you had talked about transferring water and things like that. And my question is, does the priority stay with the transfer?
Yes. That's the whole point for doing a transfer or trying to do a transfer proceeding or a change of one of your elements is to keep that priority date. Otherwise, you know, if you want to go apply for a new water right, you can put all your requirements in. But the value of the transfer is to get that priority date.
And one other question I'm just going to throw out, unless this is going to come out, can you talk about appurtenancy?
Yes. I didn't stress this enough when I was mentioning the elements of the water right. One of the elements is the place of use. And that means that for an irrigation water right, for a municipal water right, for an industrial water right, there is a legal description of the land where the water use is allowed that's part of the water right, and that's the only place it's allowed. And the water right becomes appurtenant to that land. It stays with the land rather than with the person. So, for instance, an irrigation water right, the Water Resource Department may say Joe Smith is the holder of water right certificate. That might have been the person who got the original water right back in the 1800s. The land has passed through several hands since then, but the water right, assuming that all the elements and other laws of the water code are abided by, the water right stays with the land. And that's the one that's one reason that the term transfers is somewhat confusing, because you can transfer land. If you transfer land, you automatically transfer the water right. If it's a vested, certificated water right, you transfer that water right with the land unless you reserve it. So it's assumed that it goes with the land. But if you want to make, if you want to change the place of use or make any of these other changes, then you have to go get
Senator?
Requirement.
Yes. We have an interesting bill that we've already moved forward, but if you have 100 acres and divide that into four parcels of 25, you say the water stays with the land. So which parcel does the water stay with?
If the water originally, if the description and the original water right includes the full 100 acres, then it can be subdivided. If you subdivided, a nice, neat 100-acre parcel of water rights into four nice, neat 25 acres, each of them will get a portion.
So, but if you had mentioned that a transfer, it stays with the land if the owner wants to transfer it, but if he wants to keep one 25-acre parcel, and can he keep all the water for that 25 acres and not irrigate the other three, or transfer to the other three parcels?
Yes, but, he could. If he doesn't, first of all, he has to officially reserve it in the sale. So the other three parcel owners have to know they're not getting water rights with their land. And then if he's trying to, suppose he wanted to sell what he's not going to use on his 25 acres, can't do that without going through the transfer process. So because he would be changing the type of use or changing the place of use of those other, of the other 75%. And if he just sat with, if he reserved the water right, continued to irrigate his 25 acres, didn't irrigate the other three parcels anymore, and let that go for 5 years, he would have forfeited 3/4 of that water right.
How about if he, how about if he took, say he needed, if you irrigate 100 acres and you drop down to 25-acre parcel, that means he's got 3/4 of his water that he doesn't use. Can he still keep those people dry, high and dry, and lease out his other 75%?
If he has properly reserved his water right and did not let it transfer to the land, yes. But he's got to do something to solidify his legal right to keep and use all that water, because he can't use it all on the 25 acres.
Okay.
And he might try to do something much more water intensive. It's either going to require a change of type of use, or it's going to cause him a problem on the amount of use and the appurtenancy requirement. This is probably a good time to jump to the juxtaposition part. Here's the system we've got going for the allocation and the water quantity management. What's missing is quality issues, and we know that they're very much intertwined. What we have on top of this, then, is the juxtaposition of laws, primarily federal laws, primarily starting in the late 60s, early 70s, that impose water quality requirements, endangered species requirements, Safe Drinking Water Act requirements, all of those federal things on top of this state water quantity management or allocation system. couple of those programs are delegated to the states for management. So, for instance, the Clean Water Act, the Federal Clean Water Act, is delegated or can be delegated to the states for management. Oregon has a delegated program. So DEQ manages the Clean Water Act issues in the state. Water Resource Department still manages the quantity. That can cause, you know, again, tension and conflict. And the Safe Drinking Water Act, a federal statute, is also delegated to the state. And in this case, some of it is helped by DEQ, but most of it is with the Health Division. So we have, you know, those two water quality agencies on top of the water quantity issues. So there's not a clean integration between those systems. Another thing that's missing from the sort of basic system that I've laid out is in-stream flows, and this goes to the over appropriation issue. The whole view of the prior appropriation doctrine was that the water needed to be taken out of the stream and made productive, you know, irrigate industry, cities, etc. And until later, much after the adoption of the water code, there was an appreciation for the fact that some of the water should stay in the stream for wildlife habitat, fish habitat, dilution of pollution, you know, scenic values, et cetera. Oregon actually did some of that fairly early. In the 19-teens, so not too long after the water code was adopted, the legislature withdrew some of the streams in the Columbia River Gorge from appropriation because they were the ones that created the waterfalls. And so they said, you know, the higher and better purpose for this water is these scenic waterfalls. We're not going to let them be appropriated up on top of the plateau for other purposes. So that happened in the early 1900s. And then in 1955, because the problem of over-appropriation was recognized as serious by that time, in 1955, at the same time as the groundwater management came into the statute, minimum stream flows were also adopted in the statute. Trouble was that a lot of the streams were already over-appropriated. So, you know, a minimum stream flow set in 1955 or later isn't going to help, restore water to over-appropriated streams. So the next thing that was done was 1987, the adoption of an actual in-stream water rights law, first in the country, and a conserved water rights law. And the object there was first to take those minimum stream flows and convert them to actual in-stream water rights that would be sort of equivalent to other kinds of water rights. But again, most of those are going to be of junior priority date. The other thing the 1987 changes did was allow conversion of existing consumptive water rights to in-stream flow water rights. So someone with an 1895 irrigation right could either sell or themselves change the use, again, by going through the process, the approval process, they could change that use to be an in-stream right with that priority date. So I was involved in the early 90s in helping to get the Oregon Water Trust off the ground, and our purpose was to take advantage of that aspect of the 1987 in-stream water rights law by going out and, in a voluntary market setting, buy or lease senior water rights from willing sellers, primarily farmers, and convert those to in-stream water rights under the statute with some senior priority so that the flows would be protected even in times of low flow. And the conserved water rights law was another piece of that allowed individuals who had water rights. As I said before, if you were an irrigator and you got more efficient, that doesn't mean you get to keep in the traditional doctrine, you would not be allowed to keep the water that you had saved because you're still accomplishing your beneficial use, and that's all, you know, that's the limit of your right. The conserved water rights law changed that and codified a process whereby someone could come in and get approval for a conservation plan and show that they were becoming more efficient and then use or sell that saved water. Both of these statutes, they were passed in 1987. It took a few years to get They were tweaked a few times to make them more user-friendly, and it took a few years to get them off the ground, but since the early 90s, both of them have been used quite a bit to restore some significant stream flows around the state. Not in all the over-appropriated streams, but in many of them.
Carlson?
Yeah. You just mentioned, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you said you can sell. Are you selling the water right, or are you selling the water itself?
In that situation, you're selling the water. I mean, once
you. But I thought you said the water is owned by the people, so how can a person that doesn't own the water sell the water?
Because the statute has said you can keep this saved water and do something with it. Excuse me, I should say, the statute also takes a little surcharge for the state, though. So a percentage of the water goes in stream, and if public funding is used for the conservation project, that increases the amount that goes in stream. But otherwise, and I'm totally spacing out the amount, I think it's 10%, but so 10% would go in stream for the state, but the statute then said we want to incentivize conservation and efficiency, and so we will allow that person to retain ownership of that portion of the water that they've saved and either use it elsewhere or sell it or lease it. So that's been helpful, in part because a lot of irrigation conservation is often very expensive. You know, if you have a very low-tech diversion, an unlined ditch and a little, you know, plywood dam, or we, you know, I can't really think of what the word I want, but anyway, letting the water out by, you know, lifting up a piece of plywood, it's going to be hard for you to pay a lot of money to improve your system. Some of the groups like the Oregon Water Trust, federal agencies, other conservation groups, even municipalities have been willing to come in, help finance those conservation projects, and then retain, you know, purchase the remaining or the saved water for in-stream purposes. So that, I mean, I like to think of that as a win-win, because the farmer gets to keep doing what they're doing. They're doing it more efficiently with less water, and then the stream benefits as well. Couple final comments, and then I'm happy to take more questions. As I mentioned, groundwater is subject to the same prior appropriation rules, but we haven't yet figured out a way to completely integrate the systems and to recognize where the connection, where there are physical connections between surface water and groundwater completely in our law. I mean, in the Deschutes Basin, there's a very good understanding of the relationship between surface water and groundwater, and so there's a special statute in state law that provides that manages that resource as one with mitigation. You know, if you're going to withdraw groundwater, you have to put water back in the stream for mitigation. But many other places around the state, the resource isn't understood as well, and therefore the law hasn't made the adjustment to treat the two sources as connected.
Madam Chair, could you define legally groundwater?
See if I can. I have a handy reference book here that I wrote that I'll tell you about in a moment. But
autographed copies.
Yeah. I'm going to tell you where you can get one if you want. Okay, I'm not sure if I can do this quickly. Yes, okay, maybe I can. It's basically everything. I mean, it's pretty much everything under the ground. I mean, it's like capillary, you know, it's fairly all-inclusive.
So how deep does the state own? All the way to the center of the earth?
Yep. That used to be, I mean, you know, one of the problems with groundwater, and Oregon is actually somewhat simpler in the fact that we at least apply the same legal system, prior appropriation, to surface and groundwater. There are actually five different groundwater doctrines around the country. So there are some places where you have either a riparian system on the surface or a prior appropriation system, and then you have something completely different for groundwater. And the reason that is, and the reason that even Oregon started regulating groundwater later, is again because of science and history. We didn't, you know, you couldn't see it. I mean, you don't understand groundwater in the same way you understand surface water. You can't see how it works and where it's going. And so some of the early doctrines gave ownership of the groundwater to the center of the earth, to the overlying landowner, and said, you know, it's yours, and you can do whatever you want to it. And that means that people were drilling down and essentially, you know, sucking all their neighbors' groundwater out as well, and doing it perfectly legally. Over time, most states have tried to soften that rule by at least recognizing that you have to share what's in an aquifer, you know, among overlying landowners. But the only state that has comprehensively that's trying to comprehensively manage most of its groundwater, not all, but most of its groundwater is, well, two states, Colorado and Arizona, both take a fairly aggressive management attack to groundwater. But one of the things it requires is a lot of groundwater studies so that you know where the resource is, how it moves, you know, what it's connected to, and so forth. And I know that one of the things that will be coming up this session is the Water Resource Department's desire to try to revive some of the funding for some of those groundwater studies, because they've fallen very far short of adequate the last few years.
And thank you for bringing that up, because we have been woefully underfunding our groundwater studies in the state. And one thing that you mentioned the exempt groundwater statute, which I worked on for several sessions, but we have over 250,000 exempt groundwater wells.
Yes.
We do not know what the cumulative impact of those wells
are. And that's one of, I should have mentioned that earlier, because that's a very important exemption to the requirement for a water right. You know, I mean, most uses of groundwater and surface water in the state require a permit. One of the exemptions is a single well that serves a single dwelling or a group of dwellings up to 15,000 gallons per day. And that is way more than a single family or even a few homes need for water supply. And
teenagers?
That's true, I know. My 17-year-old takes 3 showers a day. It's still, I mean, even that, you know, most families use about 100 gallons a day per person. So 15,000 gallons a day is way, way high. And those wells are exempt from permit requirements. And that might have been a perfectly legitimate policy choice. The trouble is, because we don't know anything about them, we don't know how big a problem that is. And it's not considered in the water availability analysis. So that's a big issue.
Are these exempt wells you're talking about, are they both irrigation and domestic use wells, or just domestic?
Domestic plus there's like irrigation allowed of a half acre of lawn or something like that. But they're intended to be domestic. It's intended to be a domestic exemption.
Yep.
And the problem that's happened to some extent in this state, but much more so in Washington, I had a former student who did a paper called Six Packs for Subdivisions on Washington's exempt well law, because their law allowed a single well for 6 houses. And basically what developers were doing in areas of the state where you couldn't get a new water right because of water availability limitations, they were putting in 6 packs. They were putting in, you know, a well for 6 houses, another well for 6 houses, I mean, up to a development of, you know, 200 or 500 homes. And eventually both the state courts and the legislature tried to get a grip on that and stop that practice. But it's definitely an issue.
Jen, do you have anything else that you want to add before we open up for questions?
The last thing I was just going to throw out is that the whole other area of water law that I didn't touch on today is this issue of public use rights of water courses. I mean, navigable, you know, tidal navigability, public trust, recreational navigability, that's a whole other can of worms that's technically a part of water law, but that, you know, doesn't involve pulling water out for a single use. So
I was going to say that'll be part 2.
Yeah, exactly.
So I do have a question that I wanted to touch on before we forget. Can you talk about tribal treaty rights and where tribal...
Yes.
Folks who were here way before us.
Yes,
and,
excellent
where
question.
Where their rights fall into Oregon water law.
And that is a very important point, and I actually had a note here, and I skipped right over it, that one of the issues of federalism, essentially, is that tribal water rights are determined by federal law. And so that's another place where state law and federal law are sort of mushed together but not well integrated. And tribal, they're called tribal reserved, Indian reserved rights or federal reserved rights, and they originated in a 1908 case by the United States Supreme Court that basically said when the federal government, when Congress reserved land from the public domain for a particular purpose, and originally the original case had to do with Indian reservations, but ultimately it applies to Indian reservations, national forests, wildlife refuges. You know, any time there's a piece of open public domain that's dedicated to a particular use, water rights are implied by the law to satisfy that use. And in the case of Indian reservations, that means if the reservation was supposed to become a homeland for the Indians, if it was supposed to give them the opportunity to farm, which many of the reservations were designed to do, whether that made sense or not, it comes with enough water to fulfill the purpose of that reservation. It's an implied water right. It's a federal water right, so it's superior to state water rights. And it's not like prior appropriation in that it's not a use-it-or-lose-it water right. So it's there as an inchoate, right whenever the tribes decide to exercise it. And, of course, what that means is that I think I read someplace that across the West, I think it was 55 million acre feet or 45 million acre feet of water potentially was required to satisfy Indian reserved rights, or maybe that was federal reserved rights generally. And there's not that kind of water. That water, meanwhile, has been handed out under the state system to prior appropriative rights. So what's happening in most places around the West is negotiations. Federal negotiation teams, state entities, and sometimes private entities are sometimes involved, trying to either identify, determine an amount for that will be recognized for the Federal Reserve right, otherwise it has to go through adjudication, or making some kind of a settlement to fit the tribal rights and the state rights together. So, for instance, Warm Springs, there's a negotiated agreement between the state of Oregon and the Warm Springs Reservation that fits their tribal rights and the state rights on the Deschutes and Metolius together. But the only reason they could do that is because there was actually enough water in the right places that they could sort of satisfy everyone.
Great. Other questions? Or Jan?
Bates,
Senator Bates, and
then
Senator Olson.
This may not be something. This is 101, so we can ask stupid questions. So
yes, absolutely.
Stupid question. No stupid questions. Senator Bates.
So the Columbia River, it's backed up into Canada. The Canadians pull some water out. People in Washington pull some out. Idaho pulls some out, and we pull some out.
Yep.
And I've heard all kinds of stories about how much we are allowed to pull out under federal law. I guess probably some international law involved too. But it seems like, from the numbers I keep seeing, Washington and Idaho get more than we do. And there's some limit placed on us. I'm not talking about limits of taking in the winter, not the summer. I'm not quite fish. I don't know what our legal right is to pull water from the Columbia River, if there is such a thing.
Good question. The Columbia River, if there were nothing on paper, and if the states, not counting Canada, but if just the Columbia River states had a dispute and took it to the U.S. Supreme Court, the Supreme Court would apply what they call the doctrine of equitable apportionment, which sort of, it's not exactly equal division, but it tries to recognize that each of the states along the river has some kind of claim of equity to a certain amount of water. That hasn't been done on the Columbia has not gone to the U.S. Supreme Court. Because it also goes into Canada, there is a Columbia River Treaty, which of course now is being re-upped or will be re-upped over the next several years. The treaty primarily deals with the flood control dams and the power generation system. And so it does specify some requirements for flows along the river system to accommodate the interests that were negotiated in the treaty for power and flood control. The other kinds of limits that I think are the ones that you're referring to are, some of them are self-imposed. I mean, Oregon put a moratorium on taking additional water out of the Columbia during the sort of sensitive period for fish. Meanwhile, Washington has allowed new appropriations, but they've done it with a very well-financed, well-planned effort of mitigation, you know, where they're doing aquifer storage and recovery, they're doing conservation projects, they have they put a lot of money in legislatively a few years ago to look at what they could take out of the Columbia and how they could mitigate for it. There's been a lot of pressure here because particularly farmers in the northeastern part of the state see the Washington irrigators taking water out, and they feel slighted. We haven't done the same things that Washington has done to sort of, you know, pave the way and study the problem and make the projects happen.
And Senator Bates, you must have been prescient, or you read the agenda for Wednesday, because we are having a presentation on the Columbia River Umatilla Oregon Solutions Project, which
perfect
came
okay.
together because of the need to talk about that. And then at 5:00, which is not, this is not a committee sanctioned event, but 5:00 tomorrow or Wednesday, there is a presentation on the Columbia River Treaty, and because I didn't want to have too many presentations in here, but that's happening right after our committee on Wednesday to learn about the renegotiations of the Columbia River Treaty, which is going on right now over the next few years with Canada, with the different states, with the tribes.
Right. But there's no place, you know, there's no interstate compact or Supreme Court case or any place else where it says this is how much each state gets. But there's sort of this body of law that determines the law of the river on the Columbia that includes the treaty, each state's individual approaches, and the biological opinion for the power system. And there have been attempts. I mean, Governor Kitzhaber in his first term tried really hard to get negotiations going among the tribes and the three states specifically about some of these Columbia River issues, and it couldn't get off the ground. And Idaho, I mean, I have to say, since we're here in this Oregon State Legislature, maybe I can say Idaho is very stubborn about these things, and it's upstream, so it has some advantage. You know, it doesn't want to help out Washington and Oregon's lower stream, downstream problems. So they kind of take what they want.
Senator Olson, you had another question?
Yeah, I actually have two real quick ones, and then one about the Columbia River. Does the state have any riparian rights? Do they own any riparian rights?
Not on the Columbia, I don't think. I mean, that's a good question. There may be places where the state actually owns some land that prior to 1909 would have had some riparian rights.
Okay.
But it's not...
As we were here before Washington, we should have a bigger chunk of that river, shouldn't we?
And I don't...
Yeah, it doesn't. I mean, that's one of the reasons why the Supreme Court does this other thing. Because, I mean, in a lot of places, rivers that have gone to the Supreme Court for dispute, it's been exactly that sort of situation where one state has developed first, and then the other state is feeling the pinch of not having any of the interstate water. And so the Supreme Court sort of says, you know, they say, here's what happens. We're going to make a division, and then internally, each state is going to have to cut down their water use if that's what it takes.
Follow. That being the case, then, because in all the law books that I've read on water, and you have to get up to speed really quickly here, it always mentions persons. So does the state itself own any water rights themselves, not riparian water rights, but just regular water rights?
They do, but it's, I mean, for instance, the ODFW owns some for some of its facilities. State lands own some for some of its facilities, but it's, and then ODFW, state parks, DEQ are the three state agencies that are allowed to apply for in-stream rights in their own name or in the name of the state. So ultimately, those get held by the Water Resources Department.
In trust, correct?
Right, in trust for the people of state. But, a state facility can apply for a water right for consumptive use just like anybody else.
Okay, and then just one final question, if you don't mind. Concerning the Columbia River, what would be the process for Oregon to be able to draw more water from the Columbia River? You know, and people talk about the summertime, but to me, December through April is the way, that's when we have the most water and
right.
It's the time to get it. So what would be the process?
That's the Oregon Solutions process.
That's what you're going to hear about.
I mean, that's exactly.
Is it?
Yeah, that's what, you know, I mean, a couple sessions ago, some farmers from northeastern Oregon came in with I can't remember what it was called.
Oasis.
The Oasis Bill, thank you. Asking the legislature to tell the Water Resource Department to release 1 million acre feet of water from the Columbia River for new uses. And that didn't go anywhere. Well, it went some places, but it didn't succeed. And then the next session, they came back and asked for half of that, I think it was. And this session, the issue was essentially detoured by Governor Kitzhaber saying, let's make this an Oregon Solutions project, and let's see if we can get all these parties together to agree about withdrawing some additional water from the Columbia during the winter. Or, I mean, I think they're also talking about the moratorium period, but that process has been going on now for a few months of exactly trying to do that. But again, that's a self-imposed, you know, we self-imposed the moratorium. And now the process has been designed through the Oregon Solutions.
As a sidebar, where can I get your book?
I was going to tell you guys. But, it's actually published by Portland State University. So it's Portland State University bookstore website. And then it's called Odin Inc., O-D-I-N-I-N-K. That's their publishing site. And if you just look, you know.
You can send out a link to it.
Is it
view all
Odin,
titles.
Is that Norwegian?
Probably.
I'll have my intern get it.
Yeah.
He goes to school there.
But the question is, will you autograph copies when we get it?
I certainly will.
Okay. I
was thinking, well, I can't probably give them to you all because that would be some kind of ethical violation.
Yes, we will be happy to order them online. Senator Hansel, I think you have the final question.
I have a question, a statement, an answer to Senator Bates, or at least it seems to me there's two reasons about water usage when you compare us to others. Number one is policy, which you've said. But also I think river miles come into play as well because when you have all the Columbia system, pretty much the main stems, we share with other states.
Yes.
Where in some cases, you know, the Columbia is on both sides of Washington and same with the Snake River. Which leads me to my question is, if, you state that all the water belongs to the state, what water belongs to the state when you share that body of water with another state? And how do you determine how much water you have, like in the Columbia or the Snake River, which is the Idaho border?
The only way you determine it, I mean, because basically, you know, we're not the only state that declares all the water belonging to us. I mean, all the other western states pretty much do the same thing. And so what it means when it comes to a shared river body, whether it's shared side to side, like the Columbia, or upstream, downstream, like, you know, many, many other rivers and the Columbia, the only way you can, I mean, there are sort of five ways of interstate allocation. One is you fight it out before the Supreme Court, and they make an allocation, and they sort of say, okay, Colorado has to let X amount go through to Texas or whatever. You negotiate an interstate compact, which means both states agree, their legislators bless it, and Congress blesses it. So then it's not subject to the, you know, to commerce cause problems. I mean, it becomes federal law. And that's, I mean, the Colorado has a compact. Many, many western rivers have compacts. There was an attempt to negotiate a Columbia River compact many, many years ago. I think Oregon even adopted certain pieces of moving forward on a compact, and it didn't succeed. you have, sometimes you just have lawsuits between people in different states, and that's, you know, it doesn't resolve anything. I mean, really the only, or Congress can do a congressional allocation even without a compact, and that's been done only in a couple of cases. The Truckee River, California, Nevada, is about the only example I can think of off the top of my head. But it's, otherwise, the states just act like they own their portion of it until it comes to a head. And there are, I mean, we're lucky in that we haven't been in the U.S. Supreme Court. There are states, you know, Nebraska and Kansas, states that have been, that have long-standing litigation going in the Supreme Court where there's been a decree, you know, many, many years ago, but it's continuing jurisdiction, and they're back there on a regular basis arguing about the interpretation of a compact or the execution of equitable apportionment decrees.
So basically, if we as a state move forward, like with the solutions, under the assumption that we have the ownership of that water we're bringing out, we can do that and continue to do it unless somebody else decides, you know, you don't, and take us to court.
Until we've taken so much that, I mean, and it's, you know, in this situation, because we're sharing it across the boundary with Washington and it's a big river, it's unlikely that we'd ever get to the point where we would use so much that they would scream foul and go to the U.S. Supreme Court, but that's what they'd have to do. It happens more often when it's an upstream, downstream situation, because then it's more obvious when somebody's using more than their share.
And I think you're going to hear more about that on Wednesday, because I know we've been talking to Washington quite a bit. But with that, any last questions for Jan?
Yeah, I do have one. Would you ever see a case where California could come after our Columbia River water, which they've tried before?
They did try before, and at one point, the Northwest Congressional delegation, I think, went to Congress and got a moratorium from Congress on considering any legislation having to do with sending Northwestern water to California. But there, I mean, there have been attempts to get Great Lakes water, you know, all kinds of places. But those things, those battles usually end up in a congressional resolution of some sort.
Thank you.
Great.
Very enlightening.
Yeah,
thank
well,
you.
Thank
very
you very helpful. Much for spending
You're
your afternoon
welcome.
Here with us, and we'll look forward to getting the information out your book, and then there'll be a quiz for everybody. You can come in and give us a test to make
test,
sure we've
yeah.
absorbed all of it, but thank you very much, and this
thank
is really
you.
Great.
Thank you. I'm very happy to do it.
I learned something every day
point.
About Western Water Law.
Right
so with that, we are adjourned. And Beth, anything else before I drop the gavel?
Nope. Senator Olson already made the announcement that we're carrying over
Senate. We will have one hearing and more Water 101 in the Columbia River on Wednesday. We are adjourned.